Hello and welcome to the Global Energy Transition Podcast, presented by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung European Union and the Global Energy Transition Blog. I am your host, Michael Buxbaum, photojournalist and lead blogger for theenergytransition.org. The international response to Russia's brutal February 2022 invasion of Ukraine has altered and transformed the energy transition, in some ways accelerating the move towards wind and solar generation, but also forcing countries dependent on Russian fossil fuels, particularly European nations and the European Union as a whole, to search for and secure alternative supplies. As our team of bloggers at the Energy Transition are broadly covering, the sudden shocks of this new reality largely exacerbated the already growing triple crisis of climate, energy, and inflation that we continue to face. Nowhere is this more apparent than in the EU, which relies heavily on imported fossil fuels. 70% of its coal, 90% of its gas, and 97% of its oil are mined and produced from outside the 27-member nation bloc. And as Putin's tanks began rolling into Ukraine late last February, Russia had long become not only Europe's biggest supplier of gas, providing just under half its total gas needs, it also provided over 40% of its oil and nearly half of its coal too. And Germany had become particularly dependent on Russian imports. As late as 2021, Russian supplies accounted for over 55% of its gas, 35% of its oil, and 45% of its coal, too. Worse, revenues derived from these fossil fuels were, and to a lesser extent continued to be, the largest sources of income for Russia's war machine. To halt this indirect funding, since the invasion began, the EU and Germany have taken monumental steps to reduce their Russian energy dependency. While this was a bit easier to achieve with coal, replacing Russian oil and petroleum products was much more challenging. Even more difficult was replacing Russian gas and liquefied natural gas, or LNG. Mainly used for electricity generation and industrial purposes, like producing plastics, packaging, chemicals, and fertilizers, as late as 2021, fossil gas was also used by some 30% of EU households to heat their homes. To make up for sanctioned Russian supplies, Germany delayed planned coal unit retirements, reduced gas demand, and spurred on renewables growth, which all across the EU hit a record level. But with energy prices rising, Germany's government leapt into action, prioritizing the deployment of new floating LNG terminals and authorizing the construction of new permanent LNG facilities, and also by making a slew of new deals ensuring a diverse basket of new energy suppliers and infrastructure pathways. And that's what we're going to cover in this episode. Germany's dizzyingly quick greenlighting, building, and opening up of not one new LNG terminal, where prior to the war there had been none, but a whole new fleet of LNG ports. To guide us through this complex narrative, for this podcast, we spoke with the tireless energy campaigner and consultant Andy Georgou. Based in Germany, Andy is a former public servant and policy advisor to Food and Water Watch Europe. Today, he works as a consultant with a variety of local, national, and international organizations like the Global Oil and Gas and Beyond Gas Networks, as well as the Break Free from Plastics movement, helping to lead campaigns around fracking, plastic pollution, expanding pipelines and fossil fuels infrastructure, as well as LNG and global warming. Since 2020, Andy has also contributed about a dozen blogs to the energy transition on LNG, methane, as well as the gas industry's plastic push. We'll link several of these into the show notes. Andy's blogs, like all of the materials we publish, fall under a Creative Commons license and are therefore free for anyone to use, so long as you credit the material. Stay with us. Listeners may recall that prior to the war, constructing any LNG terminals in Germany had become highly contentious, and to an extent, by the time of elections and a new government coming in at the end of 2021 and early 2022, terminal permitting had sort of frozen. This was partially due to the efforts of campaigners like Andy, who had long worked to prevent more fossil gas lock-ins, while at the same time the oil and gas industry and its supporters have also been pushing, long trying to sell fossil gas as a cleaner option for the environment compared to coal.
The main argument is that when you burn gas and you compare it to coal, when you look at the CO2 emissions, it is indeed much more climate friendly. But the problem is that when you do look at gas versus coal only at the combustion stage, then it looks greener. And this was always the excuse for the industry to push for more fossil gas infrastructure to basically secure that their fossil fueled business as usual. So gas was more or less their only avenue. Coal was already dirty. Oil wasn't that clean. They pushed for gas as this so-called clean bridge into the post-fossil future. But the problem starts with the emissions along the full supply chain of gas. Starting 10 years ago, we do have now quite a list of scientific evidence. We do have much better data, satellite data, but also field studies that prove that along the full supply chain of gas, we do have quite a high rate of methane leakages. So fossil gas consists mainly of methane. And if methane is being released into the atmosphere, it is up to 108 times much more climate damaging, meaning that it has up to 108 times higher global warming impact than CO2. This is when you look at it for a 20-year time frame.
Beyond supposedly being better for the climate, gas supporters have also touted it as a cheaper alternative to more expensive, unproven, or risky investments in renewables. Remember that as you look at your electricity bills. Were it not for that record build-out of new wind and solar last year, they'd be much higher. But seeing a renewables build-out as a threat to their profits, the oil and gas industry has long been lobbying to slow down any sort of more ambitious action there. And also, since we've mostly been focusing at the climate crisis through the lens of carbon dioxide pollution and not holistically taking in all different types of greenhouse gases like methane, we've missed an important point. Methane, which makes up about 85% of what industry calls or terms natural gas, which is really fossil gas from methane. Methane itself is way more heat trapping than CO2. What's worse, current science says that if just 3 to 5% of all the methane that's being extracted today to make natural gas escapes into the atmosphere, then gas itself loses whatever purported climate advantage it ever had over burning coal.
There are several studies out there and several numbers, and yes, the threshold is more or less 3%. But we had studies that show that sometimes it can be up to 12%, up to 17%. Scientists like Professor Howers, who's at Cornell University, one of the first scientists together with his colleague Anthony Ingraffia, who raised this issue and said there's a problem with methane. He came up with estimates saying that, and this is even conservative, along the full supply chain of shale gas, for example, we can estimate a methane leakage rate that is higher than 4%. So yeah, you have a very broad variety of methane emissions leakage rates, but it looks as if they're definitely not under 3%, or at least in some fields. And this means that we should completely rethink the climate impact of gas. And apart, you know, from this pure scientific debate, no one ever talked about the fact that if you add fossil infrastructure to an existing network, it has a certain economic lifespan. And a lot of the projects that have been pushed within the last 10 years Some of them came online a few years ago, but they do have an economic lifespan of 30, sometimes 50 years, meaning that this goes way beyond 2050 when we need to be at net zero, which shows us that the industry is making use of this misconception to install fossil infrastructure that will cause a fossil lock-in, because we might be forced to keep this infrastructure online in order to prevent stranded assets.
Going back to February 2022 and the eve of the invasion of Ukraine, Germany really was upside down in terms of its dependence on Russian gas. To swiftly free itself and also enable the country to directly receive LNG volumes from producers the world over, Berlin floated the idea of securing a fleet of, well, floating LNG terminals while simultaneously reviving some of the LNG projects which had been languishing ahead of the war. And now, with the crisis upon them, Berlin, one can assume with lots of industry encouragement, decided to move at lightning speed, especially by German standards, to develop new terminals.
When I've started the Climate Against LNG campaign and alliance, we have three main locations and we've talked about three LNG terminals. And one of them was leased almost dead, the one at Wilhelmshaven, because Uniper actually opted for no longer pursuing with a fossil project, but rather looking into alternatives. So back then we had three locations and three proposed terminals with another one, but this was really a small scale terminal in Rostock. These are onshore terminals and also so-called floating storage units, FSRUs. They can be built on five locations so far. So we still have three main locations that are still in the race: Hunsbüttel, Wilhelmshaven, and Stade. But we also have now Hamburg and also Lubmin on the list. And you can find the terminals and also the locations in the annex of the so-called LNG fast-tracking law. So the German parliament pushed this law through the parliament, and Bundestag and the Bundesrat also approved it. And it not only torpedoes massively public participation rights, it completely skips the environmental impact assessments for the floating storage units. So they don't have to do an environmental impact assessment any longer. And they can get permits until 2043. So there we are.
Note to listeners, since I taped this show with Andy, the LNG terminal plan has changed several times. As of the end of February 2023, a total of 10 new terminals under the LNG Acceleration Act, which Andy mentions, are already operating or are in various stages of development. Of the proposed three fixed terminals, as of the end of 2022, no final investment decisions on these have been made. However, a total of three floating terminals are now in operation, including one in Brunsbüttel and another in Wilhelmshaven, which received its first full load of LNG from the U.S. at the beginning of 2023, after going to operation just weeks before. And a third FSRU has gone online in Lubmin, the eastern port where the now inoperable Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia makes landfall. This LNG can then fill Nord Stream's intended onshore network. And for this reason, two more floating units are also planned to come online in Lubmin by the end of 2023, as well as more floating units in Wilhelmshaven and Stade near the giant port of Hamburg. As we finalize this podcast, there is yet another growing fight brewing about one other planned floating LNG terminal, this time set for the otherwise touristy island of Rügen, one of Germany's most popular holiday destinations. Recently, the federal cabinet in Berlin decided to include the planned terminal in the port of Mukran on Rügen into the LNG Acceleration Act, citing the need for even more secure energy supplies. However, authorities in the northern state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, where Mukran is situated, have requested more time to consider alternatives to Berlin's plans as they attempt to gain local acceptance. Regardless, our friends at the energy behemoth RWE have stated that they will not take part in development plans in Rügen. Instead, the government-owned Deutsche Energy Terminal GmbH will handle commercial operations at this planned FSRU-based LNG terminal, along with Deutsche Regas, instead of RWE. The German Environmental Aid Group, or Deutsche Umwelthilfe, along with other campaigners, are charging that the federal government and the responsible authorities have so far refrained from involving citizens in the planning process. They fear that this LNG project would pose far-reaching dangers to tourism, people, and nature while placing Germany's legally binding climate targets at risk. Citing German Federal Economic Ministry documents as well as planning applications by friend of the pod, the energy behemoth RWE, a new analysis by the Argus Media Network reports that Germany is on track to construct over 70 million tons of peak annual LNG capacity by 2030. If this happens, they write, Germany would then have the world's fourth largest LNG capacity behind South Korea, China, and Japan. Throughout 2022, as gas importers and producers and Germany's government scrambled to find alternative supplies, prices for gas and LNG kept rising along with industry profits. And though virtually the whole industry started rolling in the dough, one set of producers and one country clearly emerged as the EU's new big fossil energy supplier.
Well, there's definitely one big winner in the house, and that's the US. Make America great again. Make the frackers great again. And since July 2018, US LNG exports increased by 2,240%. And this is as of February 2022. So this means before the war started. And they are still increasing. There's a new deal. US is supposed to deliver more LNG until 2030. And so again, to cut a long story short, there's one huge big winner, and that's the US.
Yeah, certainly from an industry perspective, the U.S. sector is enjoying this situation. According to a new report by Greenpeace, which we'll link into the show notes, today no country supplies more LNG to Europe than the United States of America. The import of so-called freedom gas began in 2016 during the Obama era, and then really took off under the Trump administration. So, as Andy mentioned, from 2018 through 2022, US LNG exports into Europe and the UK increased by an incredible 1,800%, 1,767% to be exact, according to Greenpeace. And that import of so-called freedom gas just surged all throughout 2022. Just weeks after Russia's invasion began, U.S. President Joe Biden promised that he'd send Europe 50 billion cubic meters of gas annually to the bloc to the EU before 2030, a massive increase over the years prior. And by golly, by year's end, the U.S. had made good on this pledge, shipping over 56 billion cubic meters in the year, way ahead of that 2030 target. New data reveals that U.S. companies provided over 44% of Europe's LNG supplies in 2022, along with at least 12% of its oil. This led to record profits for U.S. majors ExxonMobil and Chevron, as well as LNG suppliers Cheniere and Freeport. Well, really almost all industry players. And looking ahead, as new ports get built and come online, the U.S. is now on track to become the world's largest LNG shipper by the end of this year. Though Germany's complete about-face regarding LNG provides a strong example for how even a three-party coalition government can swiftly react to a perceived emergency, it does seem that in the face of such an economic challenge, climate protection has become something of a luxury.
Yeah, I fully agree. And what really saddens me is that, especially in Germany, we've wasted precious months where we could have had renewable energy, energy efficiency, small-scale subsidy programs, acceleration legal frameworks, but instead we got the LNG Acceleration Act, which allows fossil LNG infrastructure to get permits until 2043. There's no environmental impact assessment for the floating storage units. And this leads to partially very bizarre scenarios where, even if you skip the climate aspects aside, we do have a recent case at Wilhelmshaven where the now state-owned energy company Uniper, which is, by the way, a huge Russian profiteer, let's not forget that, they are applying now to get a permit for an FSRU, which was denied permitting by the government of Victoria in Australia last year because it will inject huge amounts of chlorine, which is a biocide, for the regasification process. And this should happen in the protected UNESCO World Heritage Wadensee.
Just to clarify, Andy's talking about how, despite other nations like Australia rejecting permits for FSRUs, Germany greenlit several of them. This speaks to the risks being authorized to ensure supply security. And in this desperate market, new gas might start flowing from some surprising sources.
It's not surprising, but what is worrying is that there's a dash for African gas. And there's a push to actually even subsidize fossil fuel / gas projects in Africa. And this really worries me because I know from experience that African countries, and I can say that for Southern Africa, Namibia, for example, they have a huge potential for renewables, but they lack infrastructure and the people are poor and energy prices are high, which is, it's absurd. They have the potential. The only thing they're lacking is a bit of technology and a bit of help. So instead of working with the African countries as legitimate partners, we are falling into this neo-colonialism behaviors and are actually trying to make Africa also much more dependent from fossil fuels, which is quite suicidal if we think of the global warming apocalypse that is looming. I mean, Guterres was talking about the highway to climate hell in his opening speech at the COP this year, which takes place in Africa.
Clearly, Andy doesn't buy the premise of this new real energy politic that securing alternative sources of gas and LNG from the US, Qatar, and various African producers, despite inherent climate risks, is the best strategy.
Global warming and its impacts in terms of billions and trillions in loss, in terms of millions and billions of lives being lost, this is a reality. And you have to act according to this reality and not completely past-orientated economic model that is profiting only a few people and companies worldwide that have made their income based on the moment that we're in. They have created these crises by what they're doing. So they could have reacted in a real way to this reality by doing exactly the opposite of what they've done. Come up with a climate emergency acceleration bill first instead of an LNG acceleration bill without any kind of profound assessment if you actually need all these LNG terminals and without any kind of climate assessment what this would mean in terms of global emissions that you are actually responsible for because of your hunger that is as a large part, it is not even the hunger of households for energy, but is a hunger of an energy and raw materials intensive petrochemical and plastics industry, because this is also an aspect that we've revealed this year. Maybe a truth, not really a surprise, but maybe a surprise in numbers. And I also wrote a blog about it. A lot of oil and gas is going into non-essential toxic products produced by the petrochemical and plastics industry, and includes players such as BASF. So they could have focused on that, and we could have done other measures to make sure that people are not freezing, or that we relieve them from paying these high prices. Opting for LNG is opting for high gas prices.
Exact figures are not available, but new estimates as to how much fossil gas is actually used to produce only single-use plastics and disposable packaging are shocking.
A great researcher, his name is Amadeo Giotto. He works for BaFin, but in this case, he worked together with the Breakthrough from Plastic movement. He has done some great research around how much oil and gas goes into plastics in Europe. He used Eurostat data, and according to his research, 9% of the overall gas consumption in Europe goes into plastics. Some 14-15% goes into petrochemicals. If we zoom into the plastic sector, which is, by the way, and this was also a surprise this year, because of this research, we found out that plastic production is the largest industrial consumer of oil and gas. It's larger than steel, larger than machinery, food, beverages, and stuff. And so one very easy thing that our governments could do, and in actual fact, they committed themselves to do this through the Safe Gas for a Safe Winter proposal of the European Commission. Member states have committed themselves to reduce gas consumption by 15% between August 22 and March 23. So one thing that they could do is send energy intensive industries into lockdown. And one of them would be the petrochemical and plastic production industry, and ramp up programs that focus on reuse and recycling instead of continuing producing basically plastic waste, because 40% of the plastic market is packaging, and packaging is nothing but waste at the end of the day. So instead of asking people to shower cold and heat less, they could and should focus on plastic, which is nothing but oil and gas in a solid form. These measures would actually be popular, because you will basically use something that is already a bad thing in the eye of the public. People are aware of the fact that plastic waste is a problem. So why not focusing on plastic before doing anything else? There's a huge potential to reduce oil and gas consumption and also dependency from Russian oil and gas by reducing plastic production and plastic consumption.
Wow, mind-blowing. Andy, I want to ask you so many more questions, but we're running out of time. So let's just stop here, and let me thank you again for your insights and dedication, and of course, for coming onto the pod.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you.
And thank you to all you listeners who've tuned in and stayed tuned in. You have been listening to the Energy Transition Podcast, a product of the Heinrich Böll Stiftung's Energy Transition Platform. We'd like to thank the Energy Transition team in the EU office in Brussels, including editor Lisa Santner, digital coordinator Johan Lanfranco, as well as Martin Keim for his assistance as well. Thanks for your edit and support, Dr. Seuss, and largely a huge shout out once again to our podcast's amazing producer, the Sound Guru, winner of last year's Best Santa Costume, and musical trapeze artist, Christian Kreienborg. From the former German capital city of Bonn, I wish you all smooth sailing on what could be rough seas ahead. Until next time.